Chapter 33. It appeared after a short parley that General Farragut was willing to accept these conditions. While the seconds were loading the pistols, he could be heard whistling, and was seen to rub his hands with perfect contentment. He flung off his coat briskly, and General D. Huber took off his own and folded it carefully on a stone. Suppose you take your principal to the other side of the wood, and let him enter exactly in 10 minutes from now, suggested General Dubert, calmly, but feeling as if he were giving directions for his own executive. This, however, was his last moment of weakness. Wait. Let us compare watches first. He pulled out his own. The officer with the chipped nose went over to borrow the watch of General Farragut. They bent their heads over them for a time. That's it. At 4:06 by yours. 7:02 by mine. It was the cuirassier who remained by the side of General Dubert, keeping his one eye fixed immovably on the white face of the watch he held in the palm of his hand. He opened his mouth, waiting for the beat of the last second long, before he snapped out the word, "Avances." General Dubert moved on, passing from the glaring sunshine of the provincial morning into the cool and aromatic shade of the pines. The ground was clear between the reddish trunks, whose multitude, leaning at slightly different angles, confused his eye at first. It was like going into battle. The commanding quality of confidence in himself woke up in his breast. He was all to his affair. The problem was how to kill the adversary. Nothing short of that would free him from this imbecile nightmare. It's no use wounding that brute, thought General Dubert. He was known as a resourceful officer. His comrades years ago used also to call him the strategist. And it was a fact that he could think in the presence of the enemy. Whereas Farragut had been always a mere fighter, but a dead shot, unluckily. I must draw his fire at the greatest possible range, said General Dubert to himself. At that moment he saw something white moving far off between the trees, the shirt of his adversary. He stepped out at once between the trunks, exposing himself freely, then, quick as lightning, leaped back. It had been a risky move, but it succeeded in its object. Almost simultaneously with the pop of a shot, a small piece of bark chipped off by the bullet stung his ear painfully. General Farragut, with one shot expended, was getting cautious. Peeping round the tree, General Dubert could not see him at all. This ignorance of the foe's whereabouts carried with it a sense of insecurity. General Dubert felt himself abominably exposed on his flank and rear. Again something white fluttered in his sight. Ha! The enemy was still on his front then. He had feared a turning movement. But apparently General Farragut was not thinking of it. General Dubert saw him pass without special haste from one tree to another in the straight line of approach. With great firmness of mind, General Dubert stayed his hand. Too far yet. He knew he was no marksman. His must be a waiting game to kill. Wishing to take advantage of the greater thickness of the trunk, he sank down to the ground. Extended at full length, head on to his enemy, he had his person completely protected. Exposing himself would not do now, because the other was too near by this time. A conviction that Farragut would presently do something rash was like balm to General Dubert's soul. But to keep his chin raised off the ground was irksome, and not much use either. He peeped round, exposing a fraction of his head with dread, but really with little risk. His enemy, as a matter of fact, did not expect to see anything of him so far down as that. General Dubert caught a fleeting view of General Farragut shifting trees again with deliberate cautious. He despises my shooting, he thought, displaying that insight into the mind of his antagonist which is of such great help in winning battles. He was confirmed in his tactics of immobility. If I could only watch my rear as well as my front, he thought anxiously, longing for the impossible. It required some force of character to lay his pistols down. But, on a sudden impulse, General Dubert did this very gently, one on each side of him. In the army he had been looked upon as a bit of a dandy, because he used to shave and put on a clean shirt on the days of battle. As a matter of fact, he had always been very careful of his personal appearance. And a man of nearly 40, in love with a young and charming girl, this praiseworthy self-respect may run to such little weaknesses as, for instance, being provided with an elegant little leather folding case containing a small ivory comb, and fitted with a piece of looking glass on the outside. General Dubert, his hands being free, felt in his breeches pockets for that implement of innocent vanity excusable in the possessor of long, silky mustaches. He drew it out, and then with the utmost coolness and promptitude turned himself over on his back. In this new attitude, his head a little raised, holding the little looking glass just clear of his tree, he squinted into it with his left eye, while the right kept a direct watch on the rear of his position. Thus was proved Napoleon's saying, that for a French soldier, the word impossible does not exist. He had the right tree nearly filling the field of his little mirror. If he moves from behind it, he reflected with satisfaction, I am bound to see his legs. But in any case he can't come upon me unawares. And sure enough he saw the boots of General Ferrand flash in and out, eclipsing for an instant everything else reflected in the little mirror. He shifted its position accordingly. But having to form his judgment of the change from that indirect view, he did not realize that now his feet, and a portion of his legs, were in plain sight of General Ferrand. General Ferrand had been getting gradually impressed by the amazing cleverness with which his enemy was keeping cover. He had spotted the right tree with bloodthirsty precision. He was absolutely certain of it. And yet he had not been able to glimpse as much as the tip of an ear. As he had been looking for it at the height of about 5 feet 10 inches from the ground, it was no great wonder, but it seemed very wonderful to General Ferrand. The first view of these feet and legs determined a rush of blood to his head. He literally staggered behind his tree, and had to steady himself against it with his hand. The other was lying on the ground, then. On the ground. Perfectly still too. Exposed. What could it mean? The notion that he had knocked over his adversary at the first shot entered then General Ferrand's head. Once there it grew with every second of attentive gazing, overshadowing every other supposition irresistible, triumphant, ferocious. What an ass I was to think I could have missed him, he muttered to himself. He was exposed and plain the fool. For quite a couple of seconds. General Ferrand gazed at the motionless limbs, the last vestiges of surprise fading before an unbounded admiration of his own deadly skill with the pistol. Turned up his toes. By the god of war, that was a shot, he exulted mentally. Got it through the head, no doubt, just where I aimed, staggered behind that tree, rolled over on his back, and died. And he stared. He stared, forgetting to move, almost awed, almost sorry. But for nothing in the world would he have had it undone. Such a shot. Such a shot. Rolled over on his back and died. For it was this helpless position, lying on the back, that shouted its direct evidence at General Ferrand. It never occurred to him that it might have been deliberately assumed by a living man. It was inconceivable. It was beyond the range of sane supposition. There was no possibility to guess the reason for it. And it must be said too, that General Dubert's turned up feet looked thoroughly dead. General Ferrand expanded his lungs for a stentorian shout to his seconds, but, from what he felt to be an excessive scrupulousness, refrained for a while. I will just go and see first, whether he breathes yet, he mumbled to himself, leaving carelessly the shelter of his tree. This move was immediately perceived by the resourceful General Dubert. He concluded it to be another shift, but when he lost the boots out of the field of the mirror he became uneasy. General Ferrand had only stepped a little out of the line, but his adversary could not possibly have supposed him walking up with perfect unconcern. General Dubert, beginning to wonder at what had become of the other, was taken unaware so completely that the first warning of danger consisted in the long, early morning shadow of his enemy falling aslant on his outstretched legs. He had not even heard a footfall on the soft ground between the trees. It was too much even for his coolness. He jumped up thoughtlessly, leaving the pistols on the ground. The irresistible instinct of an average man, unless totally paralyzed by discomfiture, would have been to stoop for his weapons, exposing himself to the risk of being shot down in that position. Instinct, of course, is irreflective. It is its very definition. But it may be an inquiry worth pursuing, whether in reflective mankind the mechanical promptings of instinct are not affected by the customary mode of thought. In his young days, Armand Dubert, the reflective, promising officer, had emitted the opinion that in warfare one should ever cast back on the lines of a mistake. This idea, defended and developed in many discussions, had settled into one of the stock notions of his brain, had become a part of his mental individuality. Whether it had gone so inconceivably deep as to affect the dictates of his instinct, or simply because, as he himself declared afterwards, he was too scared to remember the confounded pistols, the fact is that General Dubert never attempted to stoop for them. Instead of going back on his mistake, he seized the rough trunk with both hands, and swung himself behind it with such impetuosity that, going right round in the very flash, and report of the pistol shot, he reappeared on the other side of the tree face, to face with General Farrand. This last, completely unstrung by such a show of agility on the part of a dead man, was trembling yet. A very faint mist of smoke hung before his face which had an extraordinary aspect, as if the lower jaw had come unhinged. "Not mist," he croaked, hoarsely, from the depths of a dry throat. This sinister sound loosened the spell that had fallen on General Dubert's senses. "Why yes, mist about portent," he heard himself saying, almost before he had recovered the full command of his faculties. The revulsion of feeling was accompanied by a gust of homicidal fury, resuming in its violence the accumulated resentment of a lifetime. For years General D. Hubert had been exasperated and humiliated by an atrocious absurdity imposed upon him by this man's savage caprice. Besides, General Dubert had been in this last instance too unwilling to confront death for the reaction of his anguish, not to take the shape of a desire to kill. "And I have my two shots to fire yet," he added, pitilessly. General Farrand snapped to his teeth, and his face assumed an irate, undaunted expression. "Gee, go on," he said, grimly. These would have been his last words, if General Dubert had been holding the pistols in his hands. But the pistols were lying on the ground at the foot of a pine. General Dubert had the second of leisure necessary to remember that he had dreaded death not as a man, but as a lover, not as a danger, but as a rival, not as a foe to life, but as an obstacle to marriage. And behold, there was the rival defeated. Utterly defeated. Crushed, done for. He picked up the weapons mechanically, and, instead of firing them into General Farrand's breast, he gave expression to the thoughts uppermost in his mind, "You will fight no more duels now." His tone of leisurely ineffable satisfaction was too much for General Farrand's stoicism. "Dee don't dawdle then, damn you for a cold-blooded staff coxcomb," he roared out, suddenly, out of an impassive face held erect on a rigidly still body. General Dubert uncocked the pistols carefully. This proceeding was observed with mixed feelings by the other general. "Why you missed me twice," the victor said, coolly, shifting both pistols to one hand, "the last time within a foot or so. By every rule of single combat your life belongs to me. That does not mean that I want to take it now." "I have no use for your forbearance," muttered General Farrand, gloomily. "Allow me to point out that this is no concern of mine," said General Dubert, whose every word was dictated by a consummate delicacy of feeling. In anger he could have killed that man, but in cold blood he recoiled from humiliating by a show of generosity this unreasonable being, a fellow soldier of the Grand Army, a companion in the wonders and terrors of the great military epic. Why you don't set up the pretension of dictating to me what I am to do with what's my own? General Farrand looked startled, and the other continued, you force me on a point of honor, to keep my life at your disposal, as it were, for 15 years. Very well. Now that the matter is decided to my advantage, I am going to do what I like with your life on the same principle. You shall keep it at my disposal, as long as I choose. Neither more nor less. You are on your honor till I say the word. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.